Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. Happy New Year to everybody around the world. I really wanted to open 2010 with an inquiry into polar bears, apparently the second most favorite animal in the world, an animal that has captured the hearts of people and families and children. Certainly, when I look at pictures of polar bears sitting on thin ice or not able to be in their proper habitats, my heart goes out to them and my concern and worry goes out to them. I'm sure that's true for everybody around the world. And so many times in life, when a subject or a focus becomes politicized, oftentimes we miss the facts. We miss some elemental, integral aspects of whatever that focus is that may be taken out of context, or we're only getting a small snapshot of information, so it looks like that's all the information or the major focus of information. So I want to invite you to journey with me with a man who has spent many, many years focused in the field on polar bears. His name is Dr. Mitch Taylor. He's worked on polar bears for the past 31 years and has been a polar bear biologist for the Northwest Territories and Nunavut Territory, Canada, for 22 years. He's a member of the IUCN/SSC Polar Bear Specialist Group and Canada's Federal Provincial Polar Bear Technical Committee until 2008. Dr. Taylor has published over 50 scientific papers on polar bear-related topics, has conducted and participated in field research programs on most of the world's polar bear populations. Most recently, Dr. Taylor and colleagues completed the Davis Strait Population Inventory, which is one of the most southern of all polar bear populations, and was the co-author on Canada's COSEWIC Polar Bear Draft Status Report. From 2004 to 2008, Dr. Taylor has also been the manager of the Decentralized and Relocated Wildlife Research Section and is currently an adjunct professor and contract lecturer at Lakehead University. He maintains a private contracting business practice in the Thunder Bay area, and his current research interests include polar bear population enumeration and demography, managing polar bears in a changing environment, and climate change. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Mitch Taylor to It's Rainmaking Time. Good day, sir.
Good day, Kim. Thanks for having me on.
You have quite a controversial reputation, and we cannot leave the elephant that's in the room as if it's not in the room. What is the controversy about regarding your studies and what it is that you've talked about? And maybe we can get that out of the way so that then we can really talk about the most important part of your work, which is on polar bears.
Well, sea ice has declined over the last 30 years in the Arctic, and the IPCC has published a number of things indicating that that they feel that the reason for the warming trend and the sea ice decline that has been observed is anthropogenic carbon dioxide accumulation in the atmosphere. So greenhouse warming has been accepted by most of my colleagues as the cause of sea ice declines, and because the carbon dioxide is forecast to continue to accumulate and the warming from that is progressive, they're quite concerned about polar bear populations throughout the Arctic Basin because they feel that this warming trend will cause continued erosion and deterioration of the sea ice habitat and have first nutritional, then demographic impacts on polar bear populations throughout the basin. So I on the other hand, do not feel that the evidence for anthropogenic global warming is all that convincing. I'm certainly not denying that there was a warming trend in the 80s and 90s, nor am I denying that that the sea ice has generally declined from historical levels in the previous century. But when I look at the arguments that are presented for how that occurs, and especially the last 10 years of data, which shows that globally, at least, warming was first arrested, and now the Earth has cooled since 2003. I start to wonder if the cause is perhaps not not more natural, and if it is natural, maybe less likely to be progressive. And so I think there's more room for optimism regarding polar bear populations.
Yeah, I did not know that the sea ice was melting literally. I really, like some other people out there, thought that maybe it was taken out of context. So let's talk about the sea ice, since this is where the action is. Is it melting? And if it is melting and has been melting, what do you think it's from?
Well, the sea ice is basically, there's a distinct seasonality to the Arctic. It's freezes in the winter and melts in the summer. That's nothing new. But the degree of melting and the onset of freezing is kind of what's changed. And my colleagues in Canada have observed is that, especially in some of the southern populations like Western Hudson Bay, the sea ice melts every year. In Hudson Bay, the ice is completely gone, and the bears come ashore for that open water season and have a kind of a land retreat during summer, and then return to the ice when it freezes again, except for the denning females. When it freezes again, and that's part of their annual cycle, that's part of their ecology, they're adapted to that. But as that open water period gets longer and longer, that means they spend an increasing number of days on shore fasting. And over time, again, through long-term studies, they identified a decline in body mass, and then eventually a decline in recruitment, and then a decline in some of the survival rates, and eventually even documented a population decline. And while I could probably quarrel with my colleagues about some of the aspects of that study, I think the evidence is pretty strong that that's actually occurred. So, at the same time, not exactly concurrently, but over time, colleagues in Alaska with USGS program there have seen, especially sea ice in the Beaufort Sea, especially in the last decade, retreat a lot in the summer, and the sea ice has declined even through the spring months to the point where they had difficulty conducting research programs that used to be fairly routine, simply because the ice was so broken and so far offshore. And the results of their study indicated that there's also been a dramatic decline in survival rates of all sex and age classes, but particularly adult females. They're estimating that 20% of the adult females die every year in the southern Beaufort Sea right now. And polar bears are a large, long-lived animal. If that's true and that continues, it won't be very long before there are very few, if any, polar bears in that population. So when we look at these things, and ice is included in a variable in the estimates and found to be significant, we can see that there have been changes and that these changes have had demographic impacts on some populations. But again, where I diverge from my colleagues is that from these changes that have been observed, they then take the next step and just look at the model forecasts, the climate model forecasts, and then project into the future what the ice will be like, and then say, geez, if it's this bad now, how bad will it be in 2050? And that's where some of the projections that we're going to lose two-thirds of our polar bears in the next 40 years have come from. And frankly, I might find the odd technical thing to discuss with my colleagues on some of the aspects of the study, I just don't find that projection to be warranted.
In some articles on the internet that have written about you, some people have said, you don't have the right to speak because you're not a climatologist. What do you know about global warming? And when I read that, I thought to myself, there's so many facets to climate and weather that are part of the mix. And so, certainly somebody who spent 31 years studying these animals and their habitats in detail and depth could shed some light on what is happening here and what you think the cause or the factors are that are diminishing the sea ice.
Well, you know, they have a point. It's not possible for any scientist to know everything about everything. And in science, it's important that we be able to rely on our colleagues in other areas of specialty to provide us with sound information. And when a group of people come forward like in the IPCC and say that there's a consensus that all the experts agree that anthropogenic global warming is a reality, and no serious person would ever say anything against it. They would have to be just some crazy conspiracy theory person who's just like not really thinking clearly, right? You can understand where people who aren't experts in something like climatology might be compelled to sort of say, well, if this is the best information, it's accepted by this international group that has, you know, government-sponsored representatives, why should we doubt these projections if they're saying that they've got it all figured out and it's all true? But then you actually look at, like, what's happened the last 10 years. Carbon dioxide has gone up. Globally, temperatures have not. I mean, you start to wonder, well, is there a consensus? What is the science based on? What are the arguments that they're really drawing on for this? And just because, I'm not a climatologist doesn't mean I can't read and I can't think about what I read. And so I began to read and I began to speak to people who work in this area. I've attended a couple of conferences that were well attended by a number of researchers around the world, really, some of them national heads of government, who don't agree with anthropogenic global warming, who don't feel that the full information is coming out, who don't feel that it's all cut and dry. And one thing I can say for absolute certainty is that this notion that there's a consensus on this issue is false. There's a lot of people who disagree and have good reasons for that. So I've been doing the best I can to learn about it, and I share what I learn, and it may be my understanding is incomplete, but I feel that it's important that all of us who are affected, as well as the ones doing the root research, are part of the dialogue.
There are technologies that exist that are being used to alter our atmosphere that are in force every day using technologies that were invented by Nikola Tesla. And it's interesting when you talk about or think about whole systems, a whole systems approach to solving something or identifying what a problem is. There are so many factors that are off the table, like warming. What would make something warm or melt? Well, frequency changes, electromagnetic interference, pollution via, Tesla radiation technology used by government agencies. As a matter of fact, there's one in Alaska called HARP. And they send billions of gigawatts of energy that destroys our ionosphere and other parts of our environment. And it's not even on the table of climate change or weather. And yet they're using weather modification technologies, and the public is totally asleep. Much of the public is asleep. So when one refers to causation, and because my area of focus is in whole systems, a whole systems approach to everything, when you have technologies that are being deployed that are not in the public mind of even knowing that they exist, and then you have a government apparatus that's saying that there's warming without the other factors on the table, and then everybody's scratching their head, why is the sea ice melting? Well, I'm doing a separate show on this coming up on HARP and that technology that's used, which is not about this show. But it's interesting to me that a false attribute would be used to say it's this or it's that why the sea ice is melting. First of all, I didn't know that, in fact, 100% that was correct. So you're verifying that that's correct today. But there are the other part of it is that even some of the technologies that are being used and deployed and experimented with by our military are not even known to climatologists or meteorologists, polar bear biologists, etc. And so there are things in the realm of physics that unless you bring a physicist on board as part of the overall climate and weather mix for a discussion, it's still incomplete. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, I do see what you're saying, and it sort of echoes what I was saying earlier, which is that, you know, most of us that are fully engaged in one aspect of one thing or another, whether it's climate or polar bears or systems research, it's very difficult to know what everyone else is doing and to fully understand it because there just isn't time.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about, or let's talk a lot about, what is in your heart to share with the public about your experience as a polar bear researcher who spent 31 years focusing on them? What do we need to know?
Well, I guess the first thing I would do is reassure people that that the issues and the problems and the dire forecasts and the bad pictures are not things that are happening now or have happened in the past. There are some indications of sea ice issues that have been sort of analyzed, and it appears that they've caused, for example, polar bears in the Beaufort Sea to have adult female survival rates that are only 80%. But the actual decline in populations that has been detected is limited to only 260 animals in western Hudson Bay. Everything else, all the other dire predictions are essentially predictions that are based on these climate model forecasts.
Can you say that again? Because that's very profound. Say it one more time.
Well, if the confidence intervals overlap, then you can't say there's really a difference between population numbers at time T and time later, right? So the actual decline in numbers for all 19 subpopulations that have been documented is 260 bears, about 265, something like that, in western Hudson Bay. There have been no declines documented from actual population enumeration methods for the southern Beaufort Sea or the northern Beaufort Sea or southern Hudson Bay, Davis Strait, any of these other populations. So 260 animals from one population, that's it. That's what the whole panic is based on, except that it's not the whole panic. What the panic is really based on is the notion that if what's been observed in these areas continues as the IPCC forecasts it will, then we'll see these things at some later date. So there's lots of polar bears. There's no real, probably, and certainly the uncertainty is great enough that no one could really say if polar bears have even changed in numbers or not. Those declines in that one population could easily have been made up by increases in another population for whatever reason, improved management of the harvest or improved conditions from global warming even, because some of the areas that didn't have many polar bears because of heavy multi-year ice may be more favorable for polar bears now. But mostly that's just uncertainty because no one's really looked. It takes a long time to do these research projects on polar bear populations. And
how long does it take?
Well, really, it takes about 6 or 7 years if you start out with the telemetry that you need to identify the population boundaries. And then you follow that with at least a 3-year survey to get a population estimate and estimates of rates of birth and death. Then you can have a sense of if the population is increasing or declining, what the harvest ought to be. And for most of our populations, we have only one sort of a snapshot of that. We don't even have a second sort of a snapshot to see if things have changed. A few of the populations that have had long-term research, like Southern Hudson Bay and or like Western Hudson Bay, and like Southern Beaufort Sea, there are issues with the sampling, which is there were logistic constraints that didn't allow the researchers to sample the whole area. For example, in the Southern Beaufort Sea, the researchers were only able to sample about half of the area based on the distribution of their radio collared animals. So they knew they weren't getting out and sampling all the bears, just the bears they could get to. And I mean, they're putting their lives on their line to do that. It's a tough area to work, but is that information reliable? Is there really only 80% survival for adult females, or could maybe that have been underestimated because some of those bears were just not available to be recaptured because they were too far offshore? They argue that it's reliable. Other people might argue differently, but all I'm saying is that if not only is it most populations haven't had even a second population inventory, many populations have never been inventoried, and the ones where we have repeated measures, there are issues with the studies that have done that, sampling issues.
When you say sampling, what does that mean?
Well, when you do a mark recapture study, you have to sort of cover the whole area so that every bear in that study has some probability of being recaptured. If some, for example, if you had if you were sampling a city, say, and you only worked in the northern half of the city, the people in the southern half of the city would never have any opportunity to be captured or recaptured. So you'd estimate the population would be just the northern half of the city, and you'd get a population estimate that's only half as large as it should be. Now, obviously, people are moving around in a city and in a polar bear population, but essentially the accuracy of your estimate depends on the degree of that intermixture and the degree to which your model structure can kind of incorporate the fact that all animals are not equally available or vulnerable to capture.
When you say recaptured and captured, do you mean literally you capture them?
Yeah, the way it works in very simplistic terms is, like, if you would go to a population, you would catch 100 animals, mark them, let them all go, and then come back the next year and catch a second 100, and of that second 100, find 10 that were marked. Then you'd figure, okay, that first year, that 100 that we caught was 10% of the total. So we would say there was 1,000 polar bears in that population.
Wow.
But that assumes that none die. That assumes that none left the area. That assumes that your sampling was completely random. That assumes that every bear in that population is equally vulnerable to being captured and recaptured. And none of those things are true. So the reality is it's a highly technical, very involved process that is logistically difficult, sometimes even dangerous. And then that's not even the hard part. The hard part is finding an analyst that's smart enough that they can actually create capture and recapture and survival models that are accurate and that fit the actual way the sampling occurred, so that you get reliable information from these studies. It's not cut and dry. You don't just kind of fly over and count them. It's difficult.
So you actually, when you say capture now, I know what you mean, but how do you capture a polar bear to do what you're doing?
We just dart them. Usually you fly over them with a helicopter and dart them with a tranquilizer dart. And then if they have cubs, we get down and do the cubs after. So most people have seen that on TV, you know, with a guy leaning out the window with a little rifle and just, you know, dart them with a mobilization drug and then... put the marks on them, put an ear tag in, do a lip tattoo, take the measurements that you need to take, maybe hair sample, maybe claw tip, maybe some blood, maybe some fat, and then get back in the helicopter and do it again.
What's it like to be near and touching a polar bear that's sleeping?
Well, it's incredible, really. You never get used to it. It's something that tends to bring the best out in people. It's, like I say, difficult conditions sometimes, and the weather's not always the best. It can be really cold, or it can be really rainy in the fall, and sometimes there's bugs. But no one seems to complain. Everybody just kind of pitches in and does their best. We do the best we can to minimize the effect on the bears. You feel kind of lucky to be one of the few people that get to do a thing like that.
How long does it take for them from the time they have the dart in them till they pass out and they're sleeping?
Usually something like 4 to 6 hours they can get up and move to a different place to sleep. Most of the time, if I've seen them a day or so later, they're able to run. I would guess it's probably 2 or 3 days, just like general anesthesia, before the bear's probably back to 100%.
Wow, so when you dart them, they're really out.
Well, you don't want them waking up when you're working on it.
Have you ever been worried they would wake up?
Well, I never had much experience with the drugs that were used in between Cernulin and Telazol, the one that's being used most times now. But in between, there was a drug combination called ketamine rompin, and it had the bad effect that sometimes the bear would suddenly just wake up in the middle of the handling process. As I say, that was a time when I wasn't really in the field much, so I never had that experience. But some of my colleagues did, and some of it was pretty exciting.
What did they say?
They said they were really grateful for Telazol. This is one that's very easy to read, very safe for the bears. It really revolutionized the handling, and the loss rate. The ones that were injured went way down. Canadian Wildlife Service, Ian Sterling and his program really, developed that for the rest of us.
Ian Sterling, what does he do?
Well, he was the Canadian Wildlife Service polar bear biologist, their senior biologist. He's emeritus right now, but still very active. He works out of Edmonton.
And he came up with that new drug for polar bears to be tested?
Well, the pharmacologist came up with it, but before it can be used, the veterinarian authorities require to go out and field test it, make sure that there's nothing about the delivery or the way it affects, get a large sample size, what are the dosage levels that are appropriate. And then once that work is done and there's that guidance for the rest of the people to come along and use it, then they're more comfortable allowing others to take it forward. So that's one of the things that the CWS program in Churchill has really done for the rest of not only just polar bears in Canada but around the world, is provided a kind of a field laboratory. And they've done a lot of the development work for telemetry, the testing of new drugs, new methods in physiology, simply because it's easier to provide, easier to access the bears there because they're right outside the community of Churchill.
What happens with the cubs when the adult polar bear gets darted and goes to sleep?
Well, even if they're fairly large, they usually stick pretty close. The smallest ones in the spring can be approached and you just throw a rope over their neck and just give them a little injection with a needle so you don't harm them with the dart. By the time they're in the fall, they're getting pretty big for that. Some people come and use just a jab pole to do those bears. I use a lighter kind of dart, and I usually do them from the air. By the time they're yearlings or two-year-olds, they're too big, then they have to be darted from the air, or darted from the ground, but darted anyway.
Wow. I wonder if the darts hurt them.
Oh, they hurt them. It's, you can see they wince. It's an explosive injection of the drug. It's a mechanical sort of a device. It's got a little barb on it. We have to nick the skin to get that little needle out. And honestly, after you do a few and the excitement of it kind of fades, you feel like you're darting your dog every time. You try to do it perfectly, but you're human. You don't always do things perfectly. Sometimes the bears behave in unpredictable ways. Sometimes there are places where it's difficult to capture them. We all do our best. We all really regret it if the bear's compromised in any way. And frankly, our safety record is just really short of incredible. A lot of veterinarians don't even accept it because we have about the same mortality as veterinarians do with animals that are brought into a clinic and on their table with anesthesia. So. But we know that it's true because part of our studies is estimating survival, and if the animals were dying after or something like that, we would know it because the survival rates would be too low.
Wow. Where else in the world does someone with your background, who do you look to for respectability and credibility in terms of polar bear expertise? Who are people that you admire and institutions that you see out there that are doing the right thing?
Well, before all this anthropogenic global warming came along, we used to look to each other. There was an acknowledgement that no one person can be good at everything, and so often programs were done as collaborations. I've worked a lot with other agency researchers, university researchers, graduate students. But I would say really the group that I look to sort of for review, if you will, or to kind of double check my perceptions or to kind of know if I'm doing a good job or not are Inuit hunters. They're the ones who have grown up and lived in proximity with the animals, who have had a chance to see them doing natural behaviors, not just running from the helicopter. They're the ones who see the changes in distribution that occur when we do our study, who come after to see bears that we've captured because we make a little mark on their fur so that we know them, don't catch the same ones twice. They're the ones who kind of give us the feedback on whether our estimates of population numbers and sustainable harvest rates are correct or incorrect, if they're seeing the bears increase because the harvest too low, or if they're seeing the bears decline because maybe we got the harvest too high. What's happening ecologically? Are the bears skinny? Are the bears fat? Are the bears using the same areas for denning? Are they moving to different areas? Are the bears behaving differently now, or what does that tell us? So even just how to catch the bears, even just understanding how to read the tracks and where the bears are likely to be found and where they're not likely to be found, and what areas do we need to budget time to really search well because these are concentration areas, and what areas are the numbers really sparse and we don't have to spend much time there. So Inuit hunters, I would say if you took the knowledge about polar bears that's been accumulated since humans have been on the planet, there'd be a teeny tiny little circle called scientific knowledge, and there'd be a great big circle called traditional ecological knowledge that's held by Aboriginal hunters.
And how closely did you work with the Aboriginal hunters?
Well, they participate in all of our field work. Typically, either the interest or the expertise is not there for doing the analysis stuff, so usually we're going to universities or agency specialists. We try to get the best people there are for the data analysis. I try to participate. I've done some simulation modeling, and I've written some analysis programs, but the mark recapture work has become so technical that almost all of us have to go to biometricians for support for that.
How many people are on your team when you're going out into the field? What's a typical scenario like in terms of the teamwork that's necessary?
We don't like to have anybody back at the cabin by themselves. Usually I'm working in areas that are remote. I'm not working out of communities. So usually we have two people back at the cabin that are kind of, doing the camp chores and getting the meals ready. And there's four of us out working in the helicopter. Usually it'll be one person like myself who's got the experience that's kind of leading the team. We're very, very careful to pick only the best pilots because most of the capture work, the actual catching the bear, has more to do with the pilot and his skill than it does with the biologist or the shooter or whatever. Local people participate. They're part of the regular crew. Sometimes there's an assistant biologist. Sometimes there's a university professor. Sometimes there's a graduate student. Sometimes there's someone from another agency because it's a shared population. So the crew varies depending on where you're working and who else is involved, but usually there's four in the helicopter and two back at the base camp.
Wow. So have you ever been scared when you've been in the helicopter that it got too low or too close to the bear or that it could go out of control? Because helicopters aren't considered safe like airplanes. What do you think?
Oh, I think helicopters are safer than airplanes. The auto-rotation characteristics, if an engine failure occurs, it'll let you set it down safely in even very, very difficult terrain, which often we're flying over. I'd be lying if I didn't say I didn't feel a little twinge now and again. But honestly, the pilots that we fly with are so good that they're just extraordinary. I've always felt very safe and very comfortable when I was in their hands. I felt more concerned about domestic flights, frankly, sometimes, but that's just me.
Do you fly helicopters?
Oh, no. I mean, I've talked it over with pilots. My focus is on the bears, and I think everyone agreed it would be a tremendous mistake if I ever attempted to fly anything. So I'm a passenger and happy to be there.
I wonder what would make somebody want to become a helicopter pilot to capture the polar bears for study.
Yeah. Some people are just gifted. Their vision, their ability to keep track of all the things that are happening at once, like wind direction and movement of the bear and obstacles on the ground, to monitor their equipment, make sure that they've got the power they need to do the maneuvers they need to do, just dance in there nice and close so you can make a good shot, keep the bear out of trouble while he's going down. And I think for many pilots, they need the wages to live and pay their expenses and feed their families and everything. But the opportunity to do something well that not very many people in the world could even begin to do, I think that's more of the motivation than the wages.
It's a very different kind of work, isn't it? Like, totally. Don't you miss that, being in the field right now?
Oh, I can already talk about it. But, I had my day, and I'm 61 now. I could still get out there and pound darts into polar bears, I guess, but it's time for the next generation to step up and take their turn, and you know, you don't want to keep it something too long and embarrass yourself.
What's the greatest thing that you miss right now about not being in the field?
Well, it's just the there's no one thing. It's the bears, the hunters, and sharing that information, you know, in context in the field, working with close colleagues. I mean, you're almost like a family out there. You're sharing the same food. You're sharing the same living conditions. You're sharing the same dangers, the same good experiences, the same bad experiences. You're part of a team. There's a sense of community there. I miss that. It's a real privilege to be able to have access to the funding that's required to do the field work. And I always took that seriously. I always tried to do it well. But in the end, I have to say that there was it was about more than the money for me too.
Who funds this type of research?
The public, through tax revenues. Most of this work is done by government. University people do get involved, and sometimes they bring contributions from NSERC, but that's also tax money. Environmental organizations contribute. Polar Bears International, or Wildlife Fund, or two that I know about. Their access to funding is less, and it's more token and kind of in support funds. The bulk of it's really carried by the jurisdictions that have the mandate for management.
Did you retire by choice?
Yes, I have to say that I left the government of Nunavut by choice. I wouldn't really say that I retired. I know there's a lot of people who would like to believe that, but that's just wishful thinking. It was time for me to make the move, and an opportunity came to do it in a way that was favorable to me, so I took it.
If you had a chance right now and funding was available, would you go back out in the field?
I go back out to help teach someone who was in a position to benefit from the training and who had the commitment to take it forward for many, many years. Doing the field work just to be in the field and to see the bears, it's too much respect for the bears. Aboriginal people don't really like researchers just playing with the animals if there's not some point to it. I'd do it provided I was convinced that the impact on the bears and the kind of the confrontation with cultural values was warranted, that the information was going to be valuable enough.
Do people eat the bears?
Oh, yeah. The bears, it's a good to eat. It's essentially a very welcome and very prized change to seals, walrus. It's highly prized. And many of the communities, the quota tags are allocated for hunters to go out and harvest the bears for food, which is then shared with the whole community.
Do they kill them painfully or quickly? How do they kill them?
Well, they shoot them, and it's not painful. It's painful, but it's an approved way to do euthanasia. They try to minimize the pain, of course, but it's hunting.
You know, a lot of hunting is very inhuman, and you know what? Sometimes what goes on. A lot of times, what goes on in hunting is that the animal is. The animals don't die quickly, and a lot of times they suffer immensely if they're not killed properly.
It can happen, but it doesn't happen very often in the Northwest Territories and in Nunavut, where I lived. And the reason is because Aboriginal people are the ones doing most of the hunting, and essentially their regard for wildlife is paramount, and it would just be viewed as a disrespectful way to behave. And even at very young ages, like even grade school, kids are taught how to have the right attitudes toward animals, the right way to do a hunt. Hunting is a very big part of the culture there, and you can't be around people like that without it rubbing off a little bit. So,
amazing. That's nice.
But I can't really speak to hunting in the South because I haven't been in the South much.
Are there other polar bear experts that you get a chance to talk to and converse with now that you're not in the field and that you're teaching full-time?
I do speak to other people, not as wide a circle as I did when I was Nunavut, for example. When I was working there, it has or shares half of the world's polar bears. So what we were doing in Nunavut had a big impact on not just Canada, but the whole circumpolar basin populations there. I still converse with people who have worked on polar bears in universities. I'm not part of the polar bear specialist group anymore. I don't go to the polar bear technical meetings because that's mainly jurisdictional representatives. So those contacts are not occurring simply because there's no reason to have them. But I still contact some of my old colleagues occasionally, and I'm still working on papers with colleagues that are still active in the field and younger people.
Is there anything unique that the polar bears teach us?
Well, I don't know that the polar bears are really teaching anything. I think they exist without our support. If we can just like organize our hunting to the point where we don't cause populations to decline, and I think that's in pretty good shape, not just in Canada but around the world. Polar bears are pretty good at taking care of themselves. What is going to happen with climate in the future and what impacts that's going to have on polar bears are a big question, but we know polar bears have persisted throughout some fairly significant climate fluctuations in the past, you know, ice ages and interglacial periods, and some of those were even warmer than the times are now. But that does not mean that we should sort of just, you know, take it for granted that they can handle anything we hand out. I mean, it's important to respect them, but you know, you shouldn't sell them short either. I guess I don't really know how to answer that.
Okay. I know it was an unusual question. There's another polar bear expert named Marcus, and I don't know his last name, Dr. Marcus in Canada.
Marcus Dick.
Yes. Talk about him.
Well, I've worked with Marcus. He's been involved in the Polar Bear Project already twice in his career in a support capacity. He's now doing his PhD at University of Queens. Very, very hardworking individual. As with most young people, new people, he has some very, very interesting new ideas. Looking at polar bear genetics, looking at polar bear nutrition, polar bear behavior, looking at some alternative techniques for enumeration. Looking at tracking polar bears actually by chemical signatures from their foot pads.
That's interesting. Wow.
He's originally from Germany, but a Canadian citizen now, I believe. So, I know him. I respect his work.
He would be good to have on to talk about his work as well with polar bears. In terms of what's next for you now at the university, what are you teaching?
Well, I'm in a Department of Geography right now, teaching environmental issues, and I'm teaching, and last semester I taught Canadian Geography. This semester I'm adding another course, which is called Nations Within a Nation, looking at Aboriginal political development in Canada. So social science, natural sciences, I'm actually teaching some undergraduate courses that include climate as one of the things we consider. So maybe some of the people who say I can't talk about it will feel better now.
What happens if it gets colder and colder over the next 10 to 15 years? What kind of effect would that have on polar bears, if any?
Well, there's some interesting things about greenhouse gases that most people don't really know. One of the things is that if it weren't for greenhouse gases, the temperature on Earth would be about 33 degrees centigrade colder than it is right now. So that would mean instead of about plus 15 as an average temperature, the average temperature would be like minus 18. Canada would be under a big ice sheet, and people wouldn't probably feel very happy about that. So, you know, having greenhouse gases is not necessarily a bad thing. We're in an interglacial period right now. The Pleistocene has been characterized by repeated ice ages, and most of the Pleistocene, including the last little bit of it, has been dominated by ice ages. So a lot of people feel that we're sort of already kind of past due, and that climate is likely to cool just because whatever it is that triggers ice ages is kind of overdue to cause another one. climate is an extremely complex science. Everything from celestial mechanics to the way heat's distributed by the oceans and the atmosphere, the scale that people have to think and work on and take measurements from. There are a number of ideas about, you know, what caused ice ages right now, but and we know that it seems to be a North Hemisphere phenomenon. For example, South America's never been glaciated, so the Arctic seems to be a key thing in triggering it. It has positive feedbacks there that tend to keep a warming trend going longer and tend to keep a cold trend in place perhaps longer than it would otherwise if it was just all things equal. But I think the climate science is really a very young science, just a developing science. And I think that, you know, in the next 10 or 15 years, new information is going to be developed and new perspectives that are just going to cause our jaw to drop. And, you know, I very much look forward to that so that we can, at least in my little area, which is polar bears, get back to the business at hand.
I interviewed Bob Felix, who wrote the book Not by Fire, but by Ice, and Magnetic Reversals and Evolutionary Leaps, and he's over at iceagenow.com.
Uh-huh.
And he researched a lot of the triggers and factors that have brought us into ice ages. And he's convinced that we're on our way to one. And, of course, there's not really a lot of room to hear that right now for most people because it's kind of like saying up is down is up, right is left is right, right? But most people can barely hear that the Earth has been cooling for the last X number of years because the primary focus and emphasis and impassioned dialogue that's been empowered on the mainstream media channels, both radio and television and print, has been this thing with global warming. So a great deal of the public is not really prepared to hear other information that has to do with factual evidence that the Earth is cooling. It makes it very difficult for people to hear that. But anyway, he has substantial evidence the way he's compiled and put things together. You should take a look at his site. And I think he'd be very interested in your work as well.
Looking back sort of in the millions of years now, tens of millions of years as a time frame, the Earth has been in a long-term cooling trend for quite a long time. That's known sort of from a number of proxies. As I say, you know, one could understand the warming that occurred as a recovery from the Little Ice Age. You know, if you look back, you know, just through the history of human records, there's been climate fluctuations, and you know, climatologists like to get 30 years before they talk about trends, simply because there are so many things that can affect annual temperatures. I think it's because the demand is for action now, it puts a big burden on the public and on decision makers to really know what to do when there's so much ambiguity that's actually out there, and there's so many people insisting that they have it all figured out and they know just what to do. It must make them mad to read all the conflicting kind of perspectives on things.
It's difficult for the public, particularly if you have been fed and fully ingested something as like a state of the world, and you find out that you have to go do your own assessment. You really have to go do your own due diligence and listen and ask the questions and separate the wheat from the chaff. And it's not always easy to do. For many people, including myself, who've been very angry at polluters, you know, we're the first people to be hooked into the story, to be, you know, brought into the story and then shown the polar bears. And the polar bears are like the ringleader. They're being used as the ringleaders for the cause. Whose heart wouldn't go out to the polar bears? So, you know, I read an Inconvenient Truth and I was hooked. I took all the models as being facts and never questioned a thing. And one of the most interesting things I've learned in my short inquiry, I've done about 8 shows on the subject, in different facets, is that the concept of time is so important to properly discerning anything related to climate and weather, that if you do not look at the time context properly as you go in to evaluate and to discern, you will definitely ingest great distortion related to climate.
Yeah, I've seen some interesting slides where it's a positive trend or a negative trend, just depending on the time frame that's selected. And, some of the controversy around the Michael Mann's hockey stick graph that, they really wanted to put a perspective out there, and they sort of torqued the data to get it. And, the notion that, science has become a bit unreliable now because people are only presenting the part of it that supports their views or the action that they want people to take, I think that's really going to cost, not just climate science and polar bear science, but that's actually going to cost science as a practice big time. Because if it's not reliable and it's not credible and it's not consistent, it doesn't sort of, what people say doesn't last longer than the next website or the next interview or something like that, people are going to start to doubt the value of science and go back to other ways of knowing. And that would be a pity, I think, because science works pretty well when it's done properly.
Where do you see the funding for true science coming from, since the science has undergone a politicalization process where there are right and left sides, so to speak, or popular positions and unpopular positions? Not that there weren't in the past, but where do you see science going now, given what's happened?
Well, if I could just wave my wand and make it happen, I would try to uncouple the funding of work with the notion that people should be working on something that's socially relevant. Essentially, I think right now a real problem in science is that if you're not working on a problem, you're not working. So essentially you have funding agencies that are basically identifying what are the problems we need to work on here, and then if you're applying to work on those problems, you get funded. If you're doing something that you're just curious about, or you're working on something that no one can see the application on, you're less likely to get funded. If you get funded at all, it'll be a token level. So if you're working on contaminants, well, everything's going to die if you don't sort of know more about these compounds and do something to stop them. If you're working on climate, it's, we're going to have another ice age. We're going to have the Earth is going to burn up. If you're working on pretty much anything, if you don't sell it, by pointing out the bad consequences of not knowing, well, you don't get funded. So it's a problem creation league by funding research that way. People should have the freedom to work on what they're interested in. They should have the freedom to pursue ideas. Where I think one thing that we have to look at right now is that we're increasingly globalized. The scientific community is, the economy is, resources are. And globalization, with so many different people with so many different perspectives on things, you run a risk of developing a sort of a regimented approach to the way things are done by, international panels like the IPCC or like a number of the initiatives that are coming out of the United Nations right now. You mentioned you had a background in environmentalism, and so do I. But one of the big surprises I had when I came south and kind of picked up the textbooks again is that environmentalism has undergone huge changes. As an example, if you look at the Millennium Ecosystem Report, and you look at some of the recommendations they have for how can we address environmental problems, especially in the developing world where most of the population growth is occurring, the notion is that we're going to do that by economic norming, building up economies, and by working towards social justice goals like equality for women, and that those things will cause the birth rate to go down, and when the birth rate goes down, the impact people have on the environment will go down. And so the goals for environmental things like contaminants and conservation of species and forests, but the goals have become political and social. not the ones that I remember from my graduate school days that were more targeting companies and practices, regulatory process. And is this a good thing? Is it taking us a direction that's going to be positive and result in success? Or is this just human nature, you know, and politics expressing themselves? And these things are not even being discussed right now, but they should be. I think it's all part of the same problem. Things have changed, and I'm not sure it's for the better.
I'm not sure it's for the better either. Is there anything that you would like to share that you would like to leave the public with regarding your 31 years with polar bears?
Sure. I guess what I'd like to leave people with is, please don't believe a thing I've said. Please go online, go to your library, talk to other experts, think about what I've said. Is it consistent? Does it make sense? And do the same to everybody else. Because even though everybody's busy, and even though there's a lot of technical areas out there and you can't master them all, there's absolutely no substitute to thinking for yourself. I mean, you have to understand that you can't believe everything you're told. You have to look into it if you are concerned, and you have to think for yourself, and you have to be willing to change your mind if new information comes available. So it's not just from polar bears, but from everything else. I would just encourage people to keep an open mind, think for themselves, be critical of everything you read and everything you hear.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking to Dr. Mitch Taylor, who has worked on polar bears for the past 31 years as a polar bear biologist for the Northwest Territories and Nunavut Territory, Canada, for 22 years. If you have any questions or would like to leave any comments after this interview is posted, please feel free to do so. Dr. Taylor, we will welcome you back with other polar bear experts in the future, and we look forward to taking comments from listeners and readers. And we thank you today for opening up 2010, focusing on the second most favorite animal in the world, polar bears. It's rainmaking time.